The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Nicodemus chapter 3. I have a few minor comments with regard to the structure of this passage. At a formal level, if you look for formal clues in the text itself, an important consideration is one that I mentioned last time, namely the fact, or what appears to be a fact, that the passage is linked with the preceding passage by the repetition of the word anthropos, or man. It looks like more than just a coincidence or a trivial matter. The term anthropos receives something of an emphasis at the end of chapter 2. It is repeated twice in verse 25. He didn't have need that anyone should give witness concerning to anthropo, for he himself knew what was in to anthropo. And then next thing you know is en de anthropos, ek ton pharisaion. Already, perhaps, John is inviting us to link the story of Nicodemus with the ambiguities about people's reaction to Jesus. Now, maybe that's reading too much into just a verbal link like that. But I think as we look at some other material in the passage, that approach may be confirmed. You might keep in mind that at least some scholars, I'm thinking specifically of Beasley Murray in his commentary, actually sees the last three verses of chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, as part of the Nicodemus story. And in fact, at least the Nestle Allen text has a new paragraph beginning in 23 and then continuing through chapter 3. And I think that's quite a defensible approach to the structuring of the material here. Perhaps more significant is the picking up of the theme of water, which we have already seen somewhat subtly in chapter 1, a little bit more directly, with regard to the wedding of Cana. And now it becomes a little more prominent. And at this point, to the theme of water is added that of spirit. And in doing so, the passage really does prepare you to read chapter 4 more meaningfully, where you have the story of Jesus being thirsty and asking for water, and the woman's responses, and then the reference to the Spirit comes up also in that passage. So you really want to look at the story of Nicodemus not in isolation from the rest of the material, but as being very closely linked literarily and thematically to what precedes and what follows. Furthermore, if you look at chapter 3 as a whole, the chapter is often viewed as having a twofold frame itself or structure. The first part focusing on Nicodemus, the second part focusing on John the Baptist, and then each section can be further subdivided into two subsections. So you can have a neatly parallel structure. The first section consists, number one, of the interview with Nicodemus. verses 1 to 15. And incidentally, those 15 verses can be viewed as being structured around three questions asked by Nicodemus. The first question would cover verses 2 and 3. The second question, verses 4 through 8. And the third question, verses 9 through 15. So verses 2 and 3, 4 to 8, and 9 to 15. But then the second section of this part of the chapter would be the evangelist's own comments. Then similarly, the second part of the chapter would consist of two sections. John's testimony, that's the Baptist, verses 22 to 30, and that also concludes with the evangelist's comments, 31 to 36. Again, I think that is more than just coincidental. It really does look as though the author has deliberately structured the material in a parallel fashion. The only problem or the only question that needs to be kept in mind is something that you're aware of, namely the difficulties in determining just where the interview with Nicodemus ends. And as you know, and I guess we talked about this earlier briefly, different versions do this differently. Different commentators view it in a variety of ways. The usual options, the most common ways of looking at it is to say either verse 12 or verse 15 is the end of the interview, and then the rest begins John's own comments. But there are some people who would argue that even past verse 15, Jesus is still speaking there. And that's the ambiguity of John's style. And as I think I pointed out before, the very fact that you have a problem here and a great deal of diversity on what's the proper way of dividing the material, that tells us a great deal about the character of the gospel, because Jesus talks like John, the author of the gospel. Brown, in his commentary on page 149, makes the point that all of Jesus' words come to us through the channels of the evangelist's understanding and rethinking. But the gospel presents Jesus as speaking and not the evangelist. And now the implication of that might be that perhaps it is a false question even to ask where does the interview end, where do Jesus' words end and the evangelist's words begin. Because if Brown is correct, the author presents all of it as Jesus' words. He is not sharply distinguishing between the words of Jesus to Nicodemus and what he's saying, because everything that he's saying is what Jesus says, only that he's reporting it as he has understood them and then he has rethought them. Now, just to make those comments, once again raise questions about the historicity of the material, and we'll get back to that in a moment. But I think it's quite a crucial question, really, if you want to make sense of the gospel. Let's move on to the matter of historicity. I don't want to spend too much time with this. We have already dealt with that kind of issue a couple of times. And the passage really, bristles with problems. If you want to insist this is journalistic style reporting of an incident, all kinds of questions come up. For example, the use of the word anothen and the double meaning of that word, That reflects a play on words which you cannot have in Aramaic as far as we know. I mean, this is a play on words from the Greek, not from Hebrew or Aramaic. And the likelihood that Jesus would have been conversing with Nicodemus in Greek is not very high at all. Again, another problem is the sudden introduction of the plural in verse 11. Now, this is totally out of the blue. Jesus is speaking. This is a one-to-one conversation. Then he says, truly, truly, I say to you, ho oidamen lalumen, what we know, we speak. Which sounds as though it is the church that is speaking. You know, people would say today that the Johannine community is speaking. Another problem is that verse 13, no one has gone up to heaven except the one who came down from heaven. That also appears to reflect a post-resurrection perspective. Post-resurrection perspective. And still another problem is just the way that Nicodemus kind of disappears, you know, in the middle of the interview. He just sort of dissipates, you know, and the thing is not brought to any kind of conclusion. All of these factors, you know, color the character of the narrative. In attempting to deal with some of those problems, you know, we can use some of the principles that we've talked about before. Let me just reiterate that when I look at a passage like this one, I want to argue that we have neither wholesale invention nor journalism. You know, these two extreme approaches, to me they're extreme. I would want to argue that we have a genuine historical basis, but with considerable interpretation. And so very much like a typical sermon, if you will. The problem, of course, is that I have no controls, well, very little in the way of controls, to figure out where does the where are the lines to be drawn? Yeah, neither invention nor journalism, but the kind of almost homiletic material that is based on a true historical event. And my problem, you see, is that if we characterize the gospel as unhistorical, if we approach either the gospel as a whole of one of these incidents specifically and say that it is basically unhistorical, then, you know, it just takes a couple of minutes to realize that you're undermining the very purpose of the gospel, most of which is intended to affirm the truth that signs do lead to faith. Sometimes signs can be an excuse for unbelief, but there's another element of signs leading to faith. And if you say that there is lack of historicity in the gospel, the author is going against his own purposes, seems to me. On the other hand, if we deny the creativity of the author in the way in which he interprets and presents the material, then we're losing sight of, to use the language of chapter 16, we lose sight of the further truth to which the Spirit would lead the apostles. The further truth to which the... Remember how Jesus says in chapter 16, I have many more things to tell you. You cannot bear them now. But the Spirit, when he comes, will lead you into all truth. And I am quite convinced that part of what that passage is intended to convey is that this very book that you're reading, you see, contains that further truth that Jesus was referring to. Whenever you feel a little bit bothered by this way of thinking, just remember, if you really believe the Gospel of John is inspired, then it's inspired by Jesus, which means that Jesus is speaking through the Gospel of John no less than he was speaking when he was talking to Nicodemus. And I think that's an element that we can't forget. All right, let's move on to the third issue here. We talked about structure, historicity. There's a third item here that I'm calling misunderstanding. Misunderstanding. A feature that, as you know, is commonly recognized as a rather significant one in the literary technique that John uses in the composition of the Gospel. The pioneering work on this topic was an article that Oscar Kuhlmann wrote a long time ago, actually, back in the 40s. The Johannische Gebrauch, something. This double meaning, the use of double meanings as a key to the understanding of the fourth gospel. Carson wrote another article in the early 80s called Understanding Misunderstandings in the Fourth Gospel. And that appeared in the Tyndale Bulletin, volume 33 for 1982. Understanding Misunderstandings in the Fourth Gospel, Tyndale Bulletin, volume 33 for 1982. And that's a very useful article because it synthesizes the data very nicely. And then he goes on to argue that we have more here than a simple literary device. It's not just a literary device. These misunderstandings, he says, add color, life, and depth to their surroundings. And moreover, they are grounded in the life setting of the historical Jesus. They are grounded in the life setting of the historical Jesus. And then he also says they are in no small measure a function of their unique place. There here is a reference to Jesus and the disciples. Their unique place in salvation history. Now these quotations come from pages 87, 89, and 90 toward the end of the article. Those are provocative comments. And you see what he's getting at. It isn't simply that John, as he's composing the gospel, decides to give the material some interest and tension in the plot or something. And so he adds this material. Carson is arguing that given the unique place of Jesus and his disciples in the context of salvation history, misunderstandings on the part of the people to whom the message is given reflect the very life setting of Jesus' ministry and have a function to get into what these misunderstandings reveal, because you know the way that people misunderstand what Jesus says gives you something of an entree into the primary thrust of the message of Jesus himself. And that, in turn, is a function of Jesus' role and his place in the history of salvation. Now, this is true in general of the various passages where you have misunderstanding. I think that the story of Nicodemus is especially helpful in making sense of the technique or whatever you want to call it. You see, from one perspective, Nicodemus is not very important for the story. Think about it. He merely acts as a foil for the author's purpose, and I think that's why we're not even told how the interview ended. Now, there may be more to it than that, but Nicodemus serves simply to provide the occasion to make a certain point. And so Nicodemus fades once he has provided that opportunity. But from another perspective, Nicodemus is very important because he probably exemplifies a class of people that the author is very concerned about. What class of people are we dealing with? Well, if you think, for example, of chapter 2, verse 11, his disciples saw the sign and they believed in him. They saw his glory and so on. Clearly, Nicodemus doesn't belong in that class, or believers in that context. The question is he a false believer, such as the ones that are described at the end of chapter 2? What is the answer to that? Well, I think there's an ambiguity which may be quite deliberate on John's part. And it may be proper to ask, why is it that John tells us that Nicodemus came by night? Now, you always want to distinguish that type of question. See, I said, why does John tell us that Nicodemus came by night? That's a different question from the question, why did Nicodemus come by night? And you want to distinguish those two things whenever you're reading the Gospels, for that matter, any narrative in Scripture. You see, if people say, well, because rabbis often discuss the Torah at night, maybe, that's an answer to the question, why did Nicodemus come to Jesus by night? But it doesn't quite tell you, why did John give us this bit of information? Even if it is true, why did he give us this information? Perhaps we get a little closer to the truth if many people have suggested that there may be an element of fear on the part of Nicodemus. After all, John himself, later in chapter 7, points out that there was a degree of intimidation from Nicodemus's peers when he sticks up for Jesus' rights. And then the other Jews kind of, poo-pooed him for doing that. So there may be an element of truth in that, but I think that's still not good enough. That John has some particular interest in this detail, that Nicodemus came by night, I think that is confirmed when you come toward the end of the book, chapter 19, verse 39, where, remember, Joseph and Nicodemus come to take care of the body of Christ. And how is Nicodemus described? He's not described as the fellow who told Jesus how good he was, or the fellow who stuck up for Jesus' rights in chapter 7. The description is the one who came to Jesus by night. Now, why would John do that unless he is interested in that? You know, he's trying to get you to think about that element. That's how he is to be identified, as the one who came to Jesus by night. And the theological point can hardly be avoided when you remember that in chapter 13, verse 30, we're told that Judas leaves the upper room after Satan had entered into him, because that's in verse 27, 13:27, Satan has entered into Judas. Then verse 30, you're told that he left the upper room, and then there's the addition of that little clause, "Ein de nux," and it was night, and it was night. And I can guarantee you, John couldn't care less what time of day it was. That is not his point. He wants you to keep in mind certain associations. And the implication might be, therefore, that Nicodemus was in darkness. And as chapter 1, verse 5, had already anticipated, the darkness could not understand the light. The darkness could not understand the light. Remember, you have that little ambiguity also with the verb catalambano in chapter 1, which can mean understand, can also mean overtake. But I think this is intended to be an illustration of that. Nicodemus, he's part of his own, you know, the Jews. He's in darkness, it's at night, and he just cannot figure out what Jesus is trying to tell him. I think there is immediate contextual evidence supporting this idea, because at the end of the pericope, verses 19 through 21, you have all those comments about for this reason there's judgment, because the light came into the world and men loved rather the darkness than the light, and it goes on to talk about that tension and that contradiction and the problems that can be expressed with those terms. And you could argue that, in effect, this is part of the evidence that Jesus was seeking to lead Nicodemus to the light. And then the inevitable question is, well, did he or didn't he? Did Nicodemus come to the light or not? I'd be surprised at the difference of opinion among commentators and the way in which they evaluate Nicodemus. I think it's difficult to answer yes. In other words, to argue that Nicodemus in the Gospel of John is characterized as a true believer. Marianus de Jonge, in an article that appeared in the Bulletin of the John Rylands Library, BJRL 53, Volume 53 of the John Rylands Bulletin in 1970 to 71. I don't have the full title to the article, but it says Nicodemus and Jesus, then something else. He argues, I think persuasively, but not everybody has been convinced by this. He argues that Nicodemus is indeed one of those people that had been mentioned in chapter 2, verse 23. That's what John intends to communicate. And his evidence consists of a few details. For example, surely Nicodemus' confession of faith, if you want to call it that, in verse 2, is quite inadequate. We know that you're a teacher come from God, because no one can do these things, these signs, etc. That's an inadequate confession. In chapter 7, verse 50, suggestively, Nicodemus is identified as, quote, one of them, unquote. One of them. And even in chapter 19, where you might put that in a very positive light, in the sense that, boy, here, you know, after Jesus' death, he and Joseph are taking a certain risk, whatever. But I think it's interesting that there may be a contrast. I don't want to push this too far now, but in fact, as I recall, Carson doesn't buy this at all. But you have the... the incident about Joseph and Nicodemus begins in verse 38, and that comes right after the comment with regard to the one who has seen these things, and his testimony is true, and so on. And the younger, the author's name here, argues that the contrast is deliberate. John first makes, the author makes a very positive statement about the true testimony of this one who was a witness to what had just been taken place, and then that is contrasted with the individuals who follow. As I say, you don't want to push that, But I don't think it is abusing the text at all to view Joseph and Nicodemus here as clandestine disciples. They are not the open disciples that are elsewhere presented in the narrative. They're clandestine, perhaps on the way to the truth, but they have not yet understood. Maybe because they love man's praise rather than God's. Now that's chapter 12, verses 42 and following. Chapter 12, verses 42 and following. That is perhaps too negative a way of describing Joseph and Nicodemus. But I think that the most you can say is that Joseph and Nicodemus are on the way. And one wonders whether these two individuals are specifically being used by the author as a way of challenging readers who may be in a comparable position and indirectly ask them, you know, where are you going, you know, and are you really going to get there or not? Now, before we move on to another topic, I think it's worthwhile asking a further question and trying to specify specifically what is the nature of Nicodemus's misunderstanding. What is creating the difficulty for him? Well, obviously, at the most basic level here, what we have is the failure to go beyond that which is sensible. In other words, things that can be sensed, perceived. Such things as the temple. Chapter 2, you can look at a temple, enter the temple. There's water. The point is, you know, that the temple becomes a source of misunderstanding for the people in chapter 2. Water in chapter 4. Bread in chapter 6. And so you have a common theme running through some of these examples of misunderstanding where an item that is sensible and which is really meant to lead people beyond that, and yet the people do not quite see that and they stay at the physical, if you will, the physical level. I do think, although you probably know that not everybody agrees as to whether this is a proper way of handling that word anothen. You know, you must be born anothen. It probably does mean, it is intended to mean from above, because the word is used again later in the chapter, verse 31, where it certainly means from above. Also in chapter 19, verse 11. But Nicodemus clearly views Jesus' words as a physical rebirth, and therefore this meaning of again, being born again, indicating physical, whereas Jesus was talking about a different kind of birth. And the way in which Jesus responds, that has the effect of transposing the topic to a higher level. Now, it may be that the contrast between the sensible and the spiritual is reflected in those difficult words of verse 12. If I told you ta epigeia, earthly things, the earthly things, and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you ta epurania, the heavenly things? It's a difficult verse for a variety of reasons, but maybe at least part of what's going on is this contrast between the sensible and the spiritual. But I think we need to go a bit further in identifying the character of Nicodemus's misunderstanding. This is a more pointed kind of way of getting at it. I would want to argue that Nicodemus's most basic problem is expressed in the words pos dunatai, pos dunatai. A couple of verses, actually. In verse 4, Nicodemus says to him, pos dunatai anthropos kanethena geronon. How is a man able to be born again being old, when he is old? Then in verse 9, Nicodemus responded and said to him, pos dunatai tauta genestai. How can these things be? How can they be? How is it possible? I really believe that that's kind of a key issue. If so, we may say that Nicodemus simply does not understand how someone can be saved. How can someone be saved? You know, the initial statement when he comes to see Jesus looks to me like a counterpart to the synoptic material on the rich young ruler, who comes to Jesus and says, teacher. You know, that's the way that Nicodemus approaches Jesus as well. Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And you know that the real answer to that question comes not in the immediately subsequent response on Jesus' part, but by the time you get further on in the story, in the synoptics, and you have that comment saying, look, the way it appears in Luke chapter 18, verse 27, and this is more directly in response to the disciples' question. You know, after Jesus says, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle, and so on, and then the disciples say, who then can be saved? You know, the disciples understood what Jesus was getting at. Maybe I'm not rich, you know, I'm not the size of a camel. You know, I'm just the size of a rabbit. Christ taking a rabbit through the eye of a needle. They got the point of what Jesus was saying, you see. How can anyone be saved? And Jesus says, ta adunata para anthropois, dunata para to theoistin. The things that are impossible for men are possible for God. But we're running ahead of ourselves here. We're going to come back to this at the end. At this point, that the language of post dunatai, how is a man able or whatever, gets at the root of the problem. Any questions so far on the things? Yeah. Oh, in Luke 18, yeah, verse 27 is the final affirmation by Jesus that for men these things are impossible, but for God they are possible. 27. Yeah, right. You know, this is not the only time when Jesus appears to be a little rude. You know, rude, I mean people who come to him complimenting him. And he doesn't even say thank you very much. You know, I mean, the rich young ruler is one example. Good teacher. You know, what shall I do? And then, why do you call me good? You know, so on. Or in Luke 14, is it, where the crowds were following Jesus and Jesus just turns around and instead of saying, great, you know, invite some more people. No one can be my disciple unless he hates his father and mother and so on. It's almost like deliberately putting people off. And this would, I mean, they would put me off, I think. I'm being so courteous and so on, you know. We think you've come from God, you know. Great stuff. And man, these miracles, they're something else. And then you get this response, which really sounds like a put-down, you know. No one can enter the kingdom of God or whatever. But that's in part, I suppose, what I meant earlier when I said that Nicodemus provides an opportunity to make a point. And either because of, well, partly because of what may have motivated him to see Jesus, namely something other than true, genuine, complete faith, whatever you want to call it. Partly because of that, and partly because of, because in a sense, it's almost like a bizarre story. Bizarre is maybe too strong. It's sort of amusing. Here's a somebody who ought to know, and he just doesn't seem to be able to make any progress in the conversation. Other questions? Well, let's move on then to the next item, which is the theme of the new birth, or the birth from above. And what I want to do is to just set up some of the questions, some of the options. Then we'll take a break and come back and deal with them a little bit in some detail. Chapter 3, verse 5, in particular. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless someone is born ex hudatas kai pneumatas, ex hudatas kai pneumatas, udunatai, is he'll think, cannot enter the kingdom of God. Obviously, it is parallel to the anothen of verse 3. But as you know, there's a remarkable diversity of opinions as to what that little phrase indicates of water and the Spirit. Now, some of these interpretations are not mutually exclusive of others. And one always has to be open to the possibility that John may be evoking several kinds of associations. So I don't want to get, you know, push into a corner and say, well, there's only one possibility that's going to fit here. But let me try to give you a typology of interpretations of this verse. And here I'm depending somewhat on an article, actually quite a bit as I recall in terms of the outline. It's been a while since I've looked at it. An article by Linda Belleville. Which appeared in the Trinity Journal, Volume 1, the new series, for 1980. Pages 125 to 41. And the article is simply entitled, Born of Water and Spirit, John 3:5. I think the outline that I'm about to give you differs a little bit from hers, but she basically provides the fundamental criterion for distinguishing some of these possibilities. The point is that there are two fundamental categories if you're trying to group these various interpretations. First of all, interpretations that separate water and spirit in the sense that these two terms are viewed, are understood to refer to two distinct stages, two distinct stages. And then the second category, interpretations that see water and baptism as one idea, referring to one concept, rather than two distinct stages. Now, under each of these, you have several, actually three. Number one up here, the notion that water, and you can categorize all of these by asking the question, what do they mean, what do they think water refers to? One interpretation says, well, it's Jewish rituals with, in other words, alluding back to chapter 2, verse 7, the water in the in those jars for the ceremonial rites. Another interpretation sees a reference to John's baptism, because that too has been alluded to earlier, namely chapter 1, verse 26. And three, water is actually a reference to natural birth. Water as a fluid, either referring to the man's semen or to the water sac, but in any case, an allusion to physical or natural birth. You must be born physically and spiritually, would be the idea. Under interpretations that see water and spirit as a unit, referring to one concept. Number one, the view that water refers to Christian baptism. Which is to be identified, more or less, with the point where the Spirit is given. At baptism, the Spirit is given, so it's not two stages. It's the same thing. Secondly, water is simply another way of referring to the Spirit. And maybe you can look at that as an apexegetical chi or something. Unless somebody is born of water, in other words, of the Spirit, you know. And the third idea, which is the true interpretation, is that water is a reference to cleansing, but always keeping in mind that there is no such thing as cleansing apart from the purifying agency of the Spirit. So it is not two stages. First you have to be cleansed and you have to have the Spirit, but you have to be cleansed, and that takes place by means of the work of the Spirit. So those are the options. There are probably other interpretations that can be related in one way or another. But that's what I want to work with. So let's take a break, and then we'll try to see if we have some means of making a decision here.